So this morning we looked closely at the first noble truth in the context of mindfulness. We spent quite a bit of time looking at mindfulness. Tomorrow we'll be looking at the Eightfold Path. And since some of you are not going to be here tomorrow, I just want to make one point in relation to this question about tension and in relation to attention. Any kind of effort involves a certain amount of energy, and energy, applying energy, causes a certain amount of tension just inherently in the field. The kind of tension that I'm drawing your attention to is that added tension. So the tightness in the shoulder when you open the door, the contracting when you ask your spouse for some help, those kinds of added tensions that are not necessary for the actual effort itself. That sometimes in body work referred to as parasitic movement, so that there's something moves that doesn't have to move, and there's but this idea that there's so your shoulder raises to open the door. You don't need to raise your shoulder to open the door. That makes it harder. And so it is that we add this tension that we don't need to add in many things we do. This comes to right effort. That's leaping ahead for this one thing in terms of tomorrow. Right effort is going to what's skillful when you are doing something that's unskillful, and there's four aspects of that. We'll cover that tomorrow. Right effort involves a certain application of willpower. There is a kind of expenditure of energy in willpower, and in that willpower there is a kind of tension, but it's not the contracting tension. That you may contract to do willpower, but you don't have to do that. That's something added. So there's just meeting what's needed for the work. And then there's this this parasitic kind of tension. When I ask you to practice relaxed attention around the breath, or around body sensations, or around pleasant or unpleasant, or any other Dharma objects, the relaxed attention still has effort in it. It's not a sprawled out kind of, you know, feet propped up, lying on the floor, or in a soft feather bed kind of attention. There is a coming to it as needed. The Buddha described it as not too tight and not too loose. So when we are being there with the breath, we're showing up as best we can. Now, sometimes the mind's foggy, and then we're showing up with foggy mind. That's okay. But our alignment, our orientation is to show up. It's not sprawled back somewhere, letting it sort of wash over us. The receiving of the breath is being present, so that we know the receiving of the breath in the experience itself. Does this make sense to you? Any question about that? Because if you sprawl back and let it wash over you, you get washed away, spaced out, and so forth. But if you hover at it, tense around it, then you get tired the other way, and you're really your tension is between you and the object. So it's finding that middle ground once again, the middle way that we're involved in. And then this brings us to the second noble truth. The first noble truth gives us this sense of dignity, this sense of a way of showing up in life that is ennobling, which is a reward in itself. It also allows us to start to more fully participate in our life with some amount of wisdom, even though we're still clinging creatures at that point. We were totally just doing all of the first noble truth first, not doing any of the second noble truth. It doesn't work that way. It's a ever cycling pattern. But if we were, we'd still be clinging creatures, but we would show up for our clinging. We'd show up for our whole experience. And in that way, at least we would be present in this moment. So that's a big step forward. But then the third benefit, in my view, of practicing the First Noble Truth is that it prepares us for the Second Noble Truth. Since we can show up when the Buddha says that there is a cause of suffering, and this cause can be known. I'll just read you the... What is the noble truth of the origin of suffering? Fourth insight, it is craving, accomplished by relish and lust, relishing this and that. There's shortening of this. Craving for sensual desires, craving for being, craving for non-being. So there's the intellectual presentation. There's the reflective inquiry of the mind. Is craving that? Is craving accompanied by relish and lust? Relishing this and that? Relishing what? Well, relishing sense desires. That's one thing. Craving for being. That's two things. And craving for non-being. These are the three kinds of cravings that arise. This noble truth must be penetrated to by abandoning the origin of suffering. Now, there's an interesting one. This noble truth must be penetrated to by abandoning the origin of suffering. In the first noble truth, the Buddha only asks that we understand. In this noble truth, he's asking that we abandon. So developmentally speaking, this is a whole nother level. It's suggesting that we have a whole nother capability. And it is this ability to abandon is why I refer to it as a threshold level of practice. Because once you can abandon clinging, then you start being able to co-create in a very modest way your life. And that modest way tends to have a huge impact on how it feels. And then this noble truth has been penetrated to by abandoning the origin of suffering. There's this knowing that this has occurred. So this is the second noble truth, and we've been prepared for this because we can show up. If we can't show up, we can't feel the clinging. We just can't. We can intellectually know it's there, but we can't show up for it. Stand it. We distract ourselves. We don't want to deal with all of this. But the first noble truth has empowered us to do that, and so it's like the key to get to the second. I do this teleconferencing, which for people who are reading the book and the study group or leading in a teaching of some kind every month or 6 weeks or so. And one of the things that comes up when these people will be asking these questions about how to present the book, one of the things that I will say is after you have read the part of the book about the second noble truth, to go back and read the first noble truth again, because it's like you get the first noble truth even more once you've gotten the second noble truth. But you can't start at the second noble truth. There's an understanding of this practicing all of the first noble truth to get you there. And then the two knowledges, the six insights, really support each other, and the insights deepen and deepen and deepen. So with this ability to be mindful, with the ability to have compassion and loving kindness and equanimity and sympathetic joy, we can then show up and go, oh, yes, there is craving. There is craving. Oh, and yes, this craving does cause suffering. And we watch it over and over again. We see how it plays itself out. I'm going to ask you to turn on the light switches, I think. I think that'll be better. Thank you. So the intellectual consideration here is around these three kinds of craving. Now, craving for sense desires, anyone have any doubt as to what that is? Once again, like with the physical and emotional dukkha, we're all well advanced in this. Craving for being is harder to understand. There are many different kinds of interpretations that teachers will present of this. But it's harder to understand because it's referring to a more subtle, a more psychological, in some ways, basis of experience, just as the second kind of dukkha is more subtle than the first kind, so the second kind of craving is more subtle than the first kind of craving. In this kind of craving, this craving for being, wanting to have the experience you had yesterday with dropping into your body, that's a craving for being. You're wanting to be that person who can be grounded in your body. You're wanting to be the good meditator. You're wanting to be the good mom. You're wanting to be the effective person at work. You're wanting to be the understanding dad, the available dad, whatever it is. There's this wanting to be. There's wanting to be something in time. We're back in time again. Wanting to be something in time that you are not in this moment in time. Questions about that? Yes. There is a fine line. There is a fine line. Because remember, from my understanding of the Dharma, goals are not a problem. And please hear how often I say, in my experience, from my view, I'm not claiming that the Buddha whispers in my ear. I'm only sharing the Dharma as I have learned it and I've experienced it. So it's a modest offering in that way, but I'm presenting what I'm presenting with a certain degree of strength so that we can hold it that way and then you can find what's useful in it and not. But if I don't hold it with a certain degree of strength, then it doesn't work. And because I my approach is so precise, it's harder to line up with it. And so my holding it with some degree of strength also helps you get to that, to get the precise meaning I'm pointing to. And then from that precision, you can make your decisions as to what's useful and not, or what you think is true and not true. So yes, there is goal setting. And so in that sense, there is this imagining a possibility. That imagining a possibility can happen out of desire without that desire becoming a fixation, a kind of craving. Goals are useful. They tell us how to spend our time, how to allocate our resource. They add spice to life. They are stimulating. Am I making it? Am I not making it? How am I doing? And all that. And it's fun. There's nothing like, oh, it's a goal and I'm getting caught in a goal. No, it's a goal. You have to somehow decide how to allocate your time and your resources. And so you do so and you have these goals. When you hold a goal as a possibility, then you're open to what's true. It is a possibility. And you're just opening to possibility. You can follow that, right? But when you have a goal that's a hidden form of a demand, then you're in craving. Life's not acceptable if I don't have a new car. Life's not acceptable if he or she doesn't like me or whatever it is. Life's not acceptable because we can do this in all three times. Life's not acceptable if so-and-so has died. You know, and that's, you know, this is, you can feel the clinging in that. Because it hurts that someone has died that you loved. But this demanding that it be otherwise is a demand against the flow of life itself. And yet, in this kind of craving, I often see people crave in relation to the past, as really hoping for a better past, demanding a better past. It can be around a trauma that happened to you, and it's so it's such a hard trauma, it was so tough to live with, that there is this hidden demand that it not be there. You know, and good luck, you know, good luck. And as we learn to, in this first noble truth, to attend to it, then in the second noble truth, we can really start to change our relationship with past traumas of all kinds. I've seen this over and over and over and over and over and over again. And one of the reasons I work with therapists and also SE practitioners and all sorts of people is that I've seen the power of the Dharma to help them help people get a new relationship with trauma. So we have this that it's okay to have the goal, but not the demand around the goal, not that it has to be that way. We're willing to receive life as it is. We're willing to continue to love. We want our child to be healthy, but if our child has some illness that the child's not getting over, we're still willing to feel the vulnerability of love for that child. We're not going to be bitter towards life and therefore have part of us removed from life and therefore part of us not available to that child just because the child is ill. You follow that? Because many times people are actually withdrawing in a way that is denying that without ever recognizing it. I don't want to go too far down that path. I talk about the imaginative possible. This is a phrase that I came to in my own practice that I use, that I think is a very useful phrase because it captures something that happens in practice. It's also something that happens in any learning an art or learning any sport or learning language. There comes a moment when you go, I can do this. I can really do this. Until then, you've maybe believed you could do it, or you've believed someone else that told you you could do it. But in that moment, you know for yourself you can do this. Sometimes people, it happened to someone because they had a thought in a foreign language for the first time, or they weren't trying to listen to the foreign language, they suddenly heard it, or they had a dream in a foreign language, or there's this moment when they're learning to play the piano, and you know, they're still sort of, you know, it's all forced, but there's this little moment when there was part of the run was just natural. And then there's this knowing, oh, I can do this. It's not, you can't yet do it, although occasionally it happens so fast that you have the moment and you can do it automatically. But usually there's more of a delay, at least in my experience, of that. And so in this imaginative possible, there arises a new kind of energy towards your goal because now you really know you can do it. That energy is a wonderful thing. In relation to sitting practice, you're sitting there and maybe you've never sat more than an hour ever. And you're sitting there and you sit for an hour and 15 minutes. And you think, well, I've got to get up. I've sat for an hour and 15 minutes. I can't sit that long. Do I have to get up? Well, not this moment. Well, what about this moment? What about this moment? So that goes on for a while and then you realize, wait, I don't have to get up. There's this whole idea that I can't sit a certain time. That's all a story in my head. I don't know how long I can sit. It's now possible for me to sit for some unknown period of time. That's a moment of the imaginative possible. I remember that very well in my own pain-ridden body when I discovered that I didn't have to move, that I could just keep sitting. you know, for some number of hours. But I just didn't have to move. That was so shocking to my system. And before I did it, I knew that it was possible because of this imaginative possible. But this can happen in relation to anything. So around our aspirations for that moment to arise of the imaginative possible, I think it's a wholesome state of mind. What we do in that moment is another matter. If we get obsessed, if we cling, if we start to possess it, if it suddenly gets turned into demand, because I know I can do it, now I must do it, then we've fallen into the grasp of that clinging. There's an unending thirst for it. So in working with goals, there's this kind of spaciousness around the experience of working towards our goals. Applied effort, showing up, staying on mission, you know, not swerving, getting knocked off, coming back. Clean effort, but not grasping. Not living in the contingent. Living in that this moment, I know this is where I'm headed, so I'm heading this way. I get knocked off, I come back. Get knocked off, come back. Because I think it's possible for me to get there. So we stay that, but not the grasping, not the holding on. So that's how to work with that, as I would suggest. And then the third kind of tanha, thirst, is this thirst, this craving for non-being. And non-being, being in this moment, I can't stand this. I can't stand this. I don't want to be here in this moment. You're there in the dental chair and it's this pain. You're there in this interminable meeting that's gone on and there's six more days of it, you know, at your company. You can't stand it. And it's ultimate. It's not wanting to be, period. There's not the same as, but in some ways related to the death instinct, I think. And that's my view that Freud points to, because I think there is thantos, there is this kind of a death instinct in us. But so there's this not wanting to be, and there's a demand around it. There's a negation of this moment, a kind of destruction, an unwillingness to be with what is, that can be overwhelming, that where we can be possessed by it and we can do all sorts of things. I'm not willing to be vulnerable in this way, and we burn out. We burn out all of our capacity for vulnerability, and we have to recreate it because we just so weren't willing to be vulnerable, or whatever it may be. And this could have happened, you know, at any time, and happen at all the times. And I mean, it can be episodic in the moment, or it can be we've created an identity around non-being. So as we watch this, I would see a parallel. Again, this is my own personal view here. Always being careful about saying when my personal view. Just as the second of the kinds of dukkha is through time, so the second type of craving is in time. The third type of craving, like the third type of dukkha, is in this moment. In this moment, I don't want to be. I find that a very helpful orientation, because right now is when it's happening. And it's the wanting to be has got this kind of looking to the future. The not wanting to be is right now, I don't want to be. At least that's how I experience it. So any question about that? Yes. Yes. So I don't want anyone. I will not be someone who takes advantage of me. I will not be someone who can have people. Sorry, I didn't say it very well. I'm a little tired. I will not be someone who can be taken advantage of. So anything that would make me see, that I would interpret as that I can be taken advantage of, I want to get rid of that. So my identity is, you can't take advantage of me. You can see how limiting that is in life. Because, of course, we can all be taken advantage of. We, in an ironic way, we want to be available to be taken advantage of. because otherwise we're not present. Now, we don't want to be easy in terms of taking advantage of, but the part of the generosity of relating to another is the vulnerability we bring. We bring, the dana is this trusting your good intention and your good intention and your good intention. And therefore, sometimes that's not going to be appropriate in the situation. Things happen like that. But we're willing to have that as part of the price of being present. Does that help? So then we come to this the fifth insight, the insight that the truth, the noble truth of clinging is to be known by abandoning clinging. I've talked about this last night, and I've talked about this before here, but this is such an interesting thing. So we've moved from simply understanding something by feeling it to now we're actually abandoning it. In the first noble truth, we're developing what I term the felt sense, that we have dropped into the felt sense. In the four foundations of mindfulness, the Buddha is asking us to know the body in the body. That's a felt sense of the body. That's not a concept of the body. The breath feels like this. Aching toe feels like this. Sleepiness feels like this. It's felt. It's felt. It's direct. We're conditioning. We're setting up the conditions for insight to arise. Insight is direct knowing. It's intuitive knowing. It's not a conceptual knowing. It's a direct knowing. And it's got that felt sense quality to it. So we've developed the felt sense in the first noble truth. That's part of the preparation that allows us to get to this second noble truth here. And now, having the felt sense of the clinging, so we know clinging is like this. So therefore, we know what it is we're talking about. And then he's asking us to let go of the clinging in order to know the truth of it. So again, I'll ask, why is that? Why is he asking us to abandon?
It acknowledges the clinging.
It acknowledges the clinging. Yes. More, please.
Because we can.
Because we can. Yes. And that's a sort of acknowledgement of that capacity. Yes. We recognize what it feels like to not have the clinging. Yes. These are all good.
To end suffering.
Anyone over here?
While you're clinging, you're so caught into it that you're not aware of anything else.
So when you're clinging, you're not really aware of anything else. So it's only abandoned clinging that you can be aware of other things. Yes.
Kind of realize the choice.
You realize the choice. Yes.
It's the big hook.
It's the big hook. And therefore you're unhooking. Mm-hmm. Yes. So let's suppose I told you about a world outside this room. But let's suppose you had spent your entire life in this room. Now, it's a little crowded, but you got used to it. And we'll say the whole building. That'll make it a little better. How's that? So people won't get so claustrophobic. So you've spent your entire life in this building. You were born there in the there's a gym, I assume, in this building somewhere. So you're born in the gym. You know, you've eaten all your meals in the cafeteria, and over the years you've discovered one room after another, and that different people hang out in different rooms, and you've had all these different experiences that various rooms bring various experiences, and so that's been okay. You've had intimations that, wow, you know, is there's this building, why aren't there other buildings? You know, there must be. Is there other buildings? And then, like, well, a building must exist somewhere. So there's ground here. Is all the ground in the world in this building? So you've had some of those thoughts. And then along comes this teacher and says, you know, there's all of this other ground. There's ground everywhere. There's so many buildings. But more than the buildings is the outside. The outside is wonderful. And you go, oh, that makes sense. I've always had an idea that was true. Well, I can feel that that's true. I can feel that that must be true. What you really mean by that is intellectually you feel it. You haven't felt the truth of it. You felt that it must be true. You see what's happening. And so now you go, you know, this building is not the whole world. This is my belief, and I'll die by that belief. That's all great. Except you haven't gotten out of the building. You're still in the building. Now, your attitude and your sense of possibility is opening up. But that's a far cry from getting out of the building and knowing for yourself. So when you abandon clinging, you're out of the building. You're out in nature. You're in some other building. You're going between places, wherever you may go when you abandon clinging. You are knowing for yourself that you, just as you are, can know something other than the building. You know a new relationship to life. Not as a theory, but as a felt sense. Is that not a threshold? Have you not crossed a threshold in your life? I mean, just really. Now, because the knowing, there's a whole esoteric teaching about knowing, the three kinds of knowing and all this. That would be fun to do with you because you're such attentive students sometime. But the knowing, because we are habit perception creatures, we fall back into our habits of perception. So if we've perceived something one way a long time, we may not perceive it that way in one moment, but then we'll start perceiving it the other way if just out of habit. If we this is the homeostasis and all of this, cognitive dissonance, all these things that we've learned in psychology as science. So it takes a number of times of getting out of the building before it's really registered in us oftentimes that yes, this is the end of clinging. And for most of us, we have to go in one area after another till we kind of get them through a critical number of areas to really know the abandoning of clinging. Because it just takes a long time. So it's not like you've got it once and that's it. But the one time alone does make a difference. I said in the first group, it's William James's White Crow. So in The Variety of Religious Experience, which he wrote like in 1909, William James, by the way, was on his way to being a Buddhist. he said that it only takes one white crow for you to abandon the view that all crows are black. And so it is one moment outside the building for you to know that. Part of the problem is you don't when we go outside the building, we don't necessarily believe have we really been out the building, or did we just imagine that? Was that just another room that we hadn't noticed in the building? It's hard. There's a lot of doubt because of this, the momentum of our habit. But we can do that. So, question about that?
Yeah, well, I guess I'm still trying to think of the transition between, you know, the insight or the wisdom that brings you to make the decision to step out of the building.
Mm-hmm.
Because can there be attitudes, but when you step out, or maybe you already said this, but when you step out of the building, the attitudes that are actually not leading to liberation or wisdom, they're sort of...
You just go back to clinging. Yes, no, this is what frustrates people on retreat. They go on retreat and they really get this thing about clinging. Again, tending to skip the first noble truth. But so they practice letting loose of clinging in some way, and they have these moments when, wow, I've let loose of clinging. And then they go home and they are thinking, oh, now I'm gonna be this person who can let loose of clinging. But in fact, they go back to clinging.
Not not because there's something they're going to necessarily, but they just want to get away, as you were saying.
Yeah, but that's not abandoning the
that
clinging.
No,
that would not be abandoning.
You bring it with you.
That's right. Abandoning's got this. Ajahn Sumedho talks about it, that it is letting it be. So here I am holding this bell, perfectly useful bell, really glad and very wonderful to share the bell so we can have this as our wonderful sound. But if I keep holding this bell like this, after a while I start noticing, wow, my shoulder, oh, my neck, oh, it's going up into my left parietal area, wow. And then, you know, it's very hard to, you know, eat lunch since I'm right-handed with this. So, but then what am I to do? What is meant by abandoning? Am I to throw it through the window? But what happened to the use of the bell? Or, and, you know, and it's such a nice bell. Why am I throwing it through the window? Because I'm abandoning it? No. I put it down. I just let it be itself. We're not smashing something. We're not getting rid of something. We're just putting it down. We're just letting it be, the Venerable Sumedho says. Just letting it be. And people say, well, how do you do that? Well, you bring mindfulness. You let it be. This moment is like this. Holding the bell is like this. Holding the bell. Oh, there's the suffering of holding the bell is like this. Inviting the release of the bell is like this. Nothing's happened. Inviting the release of the bells like this. Oh, I can see the suffering. Oh, I can feel the fatigue. What would the arm do if I weren't holding on? If my attitude wasn't that I'm supposed to be holding on, would this arm stay up like this on its own? Oh, no, not at all. And then it's released. Now, say it's a sound in the room that's really driven you crazy. You release, you're grabbing hold of that sound, but the sound may continue in the room. That's irritating. But your feeling of it, it may stay an unpleasant sound to you, but it's just an unpleasant sound. You're not holding on to it. It's just unpleasant. That's one of its characteristics for you in this moment. Although, and this has happened to many people, including me, on retreat, there can be a sound that's very irritating, and in time you come to like the sound. You know, this woman, we at IMS, there used to be the radiators that would clang all morning long. And particularly in that early morning set, they'd just clang away. And it was people would really complain about it and sah, rah, rah, rah. And this one woman towards the end of the retreat held a prayer and said, you know, I was one of these people who wrote all the notes about the clanging elevator, radiators, all those clanging radiators, and saying, can't we do something about it? But, you know, now that I've sat with it all this time, I'm just wondering if someone could make me a recording of it. Once we've abandoned something, the relationship to it has many more possibilities. Abandon the clinging to it, not abandon the object itself. Right? Now, sometimes the object goes away and so forth, but it won't always. I'm being so precise here because this is where people get off track so often. Questions?
So, is acknowledgement and awareness of the clinging or the fear under the clinging, whatever's causing us to want to choose the fear, right? Is that the road to abandonment?
Yes. Yes. Joseph tells this story on himself, Joseph Goldstein, about being, I can't remember what he was, obsessed on. He was doing a retreat, and for a couple of weeks he had been having this repeating, clinging, grasping situation around something. And nothing had happened. He tried this, he tried that, everything. And so finally he went over to talk to Sharon and said, I'm having this problem. And she says, well, Joseph, have you been mindful of it? Just been mindful of it? And lo and behold, he started just being mindful of it, and it released. And one time Sumedho was sitting, and this question entered his mind. I may not say this quite right. What is Gloria to me? And he's going, Gloria? Who's Gloria? What do you mean, what is Gloria to me? And this question ran constantly for days. What is Gloria to me? And finally he realized that the whole time he had been reacting to the question rather than letting it be. And so he just started being mindful of it and went away. I would add to that, because I have done no false advertising here. we use inquiry. So like with the bell, I said, okay, well, what would my arm do if I wasn't somehow holding on to this? What would my arm do on its own? And the feeling was that the arm would release. So we use inquiry as part of mindfulness. Investigation is one of the aspects of mindfulness. Does that make sense to you? So mindfulness in its full form is this connecting to what's arising. That's an alertness. That's the vitaka that you've heard about. And then there's sustained attention, sustained mindfulness on it. That's the vichara that you've heard about. And then there is fully receiving it. That is knowing the felt sense of it. I term receiving it in the body, but it's more than just the body, but body meaning the body, mind, body. And then there is investigation or inquiry around it, which can be a little or a lot. And there's many, many ways, too many ways presented. It confuses us. It overwhelms us, all the ways that Buddhists tell us how to investigate it. And then there's the cultivation of the equanimity around it, to knowing that this is causes and conditions rather than me and mine. So mindfulness involves all five of these activities. And in that regard, then yes, mindfulness is what releases it. Probably more than you wanted to know, but
could you speak for a minute about the courage that's involved? Because sometimes even though you see the clinging is causing suffering, it's painful. I mean, you know that your arm is hurting, but it's so familiar, and you're not really sure what will happen if
right.
you let it. You know, I don't know if it's courage or faith. Or
well, it's a very good question. She says, "Well, what happens when you know that the holding is causing suffering, but you don't know what you would be like without it, or you're not sure that what if you're not clinging, then what happens?" And this comes up a lot. It came up for a person in the first interview today, the first interview group. We had people were very forthcoming. I really appreciated it and their questions. And so we had a very intense kind of session. And in fact, it does take courage. Part of the courage is the courage to accept the failure of how you hope it would let be if you let loose of it. So many times people are holding on to something because they're wanting a guarantee that if they let loose of it, then it's going to be good. But it may not be good. It might be worse. You don't know. So the courage is to be willing to take whatever comes. You don't have that courage in a vacuum. You have that courage because you've developed a practice that can support you however it is. So whatever comes next, you've got the practice. You've got all of these techniques that we've learned. They're very important. They are the way that you deal with, plus the Brahma-Viharas as a skill set, because that's your shock absorber to that. And so You use all of that because you may get the failure. Once you really acknowledge, oh, this may turn out to be awful, you're a long ways down the road to be free from that fear of that. Because so often we've never acknowledged our demand. Faith in part is faith in our ability to respond to what is. That is, in other words, if I let loose of this and whatever comes, I do have faith because I have these techniques. And faith is because of past experience I've been able to do that. But then there's also faith is that there's something bigger than any condition. That whatever I'm about, it's bigger than the conditions of my life. Again, you don't do that in a vacuum. You've got the skills to allow you to occasionally at least connect and be in sangha where you're in connection with something bigger than your ego's sense of its conditions. Yes.
More of an observation for myself, I find that I'm able to find a community in
Yes, the naming of it with a witness, very important. And we do a lot of dyads at Spirit Rock in various trainings for that reason. Very, very useful. And the interviews, when in an interview situation, you can give witness because you're so tender and raw on the retreat, that can be a wonderful version of that. I want to move on to one last thing before we do our walking. I don't know how many years of practice I had done, and I had never been exposed to the teaching of the Second Noble Truth this way. So I thought that abandoning clinging was something that belonged in the Third Noble Truth. Right? Because of this cessation. I bet many of you have thought this way. That, yeah, the abandoning clinging, that's what happens in the Third Noble Truth. You cease to cling. I personally believe there's huge implication in the fact that this is happening in the Second Noble Truth. Because it implies that you, just as you are, can abandon clinging. Because there's this sort of thing that, oh yeah, that ability to abandon clinging is out there when I'm this realized being. But no, that the moments of abandoning clinging are available right now. That the gates to the deathless are open in the here and now, in this very moment. Ajahn Buddhadasa, his view, his teaching all this was that if in fact we didn't have those moments of abandoning, which he called little mini nirvana moments, if we didn't have those moments, we'd all go stark raving mad because the tension of this world is too great. And that we're all the time, without noticing it, we're abandoning clinging. I think there's a lot to that. A lot to that. The implication I'm pointing to now is that in your life, if you know that in fact you can put down what you're clinging to, even if you pick it right back up, that you are interrupting that habit formation. You're interrupting the solidity of that identity because you've taken birth, like, you know, yes, it's a sore thumb, but it's my sore thumb, and I am the person with the sore thumb. You're abandoning that identity every moment you put it down. And therefore, karmically speaking, you're creating a seed that will blossom in some future moment. And you've interrupted the planting of the unwholesome karmic seed. That's a huge deal. Even if for weeks or months you abandon something over and over again and it comes back, if you keep working with it, not demanding it change, but inviting it, then you're doing something that is incredibly powerful. And if you will start with things that are not so charged, you will have a lot of success in abandoning. So don't save this for the thing that's most difficult in your life. Apply this in a mindful way throughout your life. So you're a little irritated with traffic. Well, no, let's do a better one. You're a little irritated because you're standing in the lunch line and it's not moving. Did that happen to anybody? Oh, here I am clinging to wanting it to be other than it is. Look at all these other people having to stand there. I'm so sorry they're having to stand there. It must be very frustrating for them. I have a practice. I know that this is just one more moment of it being a moment like this. I can do standing meditation. I can do metta for all of these people so that in that moment you've abandoned the point of view of why don't they have more cashiers? They knew we were coming. They would have known exactly how many people are here. I'm sure nobody had thoughts like that. You can start to have these interrupts throughout your life in traffic, that, you know, someone calling you on the phone, the emails, whatever it is, you can abandon the attitude that's that kind of clinging, that kind of demand, over and over again. And so you're starting to create a different habit. You're also, I keep referring to this, you're retraining your nervous system. And you will feel in time a difference in your nervous system if you notice nervous system in the first place. If you don't, that's not something you noticed, you won't notice the difference. But if you notice, then you will notice a difference. So a very, an inspiring and hopeful message in the Buddha's instruction. And then the knowing that you have abandoned clinging, when you have the confidence that this is possible, that you know how to do this, that I would term an imaginative possible moment. That when you really know that you, just as you are, can abandon clinging, that's, whoa, I'm something other than I thought I was. That old story of me is just not true. That was the white crow moment. That's the imaginative possible. Comments or questions about that?
Is it risky to go straight? Like if I notice clinging, to go straight to equanimity without consciously going through these steps?
His question for the purpose of the tape was, can I go straight to equanimity without noticing the clinging, just noticing? You're saying without going through the steps? Or
yeah,
what? About the mindfulness? You don't have to go through the mindfulness. All that is mindfulness. If you've gotten used to mindfulness, you'll go through it that way. Be a little careful about equanimity as having a quality of disassociation. There is the shoulds, you know, the shoulds. We Buddhism can invite a big case of the shoulds. So I should let loose of my clinging of this. And in one sense, then the clinging gets worse, because now you've got the energy of your aversion to clinging, to the clinging that was already there. But the other way is this kind of hypothetical abandoning. Oh yes, I shouldn't care about this. This is just clinging. And so there's this kind of faux abandonment. That's maybe a better word. Faux abandonment, where, oh yes, everything's fine. Everything's fine now. So are you having any trouble in the sit? Oh no, everything's fine. Okay, well, describe the last sit. Well, so I was restless, and then what? Oh, I don't know where I was. Everything was fine though. I was sort of everywhere, right? That's not the kind of equanimity we're talking about. That kind of spacing out, disassociating, holding another view, saying, well, I shouldn't have this, so I'm just going to take this point of view. We're abandoning the views. That's part of these first three fetters of stream enterer, is this kind of abandoning that kind of thinking, period, at least the way Sumedho teaches it. So, but yes, so there you are, and you're waiting for the elevator, and you're impatient over the elevator, and you go, what? And you just stop being impatient. You know, that's ridiculous. You're there in traffic, and you're complaining about the traffic. And then, as I like to say to people, you know, if you want the shortcut of that, just realize you're traffic. So you realize, oh, here I am, I'm traffic. I'm traffic to everyone else. And you laugh to yourself, and it just goes away. So you don't have to go through some laborious step one, step two, step three. We do the parts, we do the deconstruction, the phenomenological approach, so that we know the parts, so we can learn the parts. And then we riff, you know, we're doing jazz in the end. But we have to learn the skill sets and know what it is, or like learning to draw. If you can be very freeform in your drawing, but it makes a huge difference if you actually know the form that you're not using. So in that way, with the mindfulness, the profound level of it makes a huge difference. I have a teacher in Rishikesh, in the other tradition that I work with, and I was coming back. I was going back to Delhi from Rishikesh, which is about a 4-hour train ride out of Delhi. I was coming back to Delhi, and an American teacher had been over in India, in Rishikesh, teaching his students. And so a bunch of them, they filled up all the seats on the train, and a bunch of them were seated right behind me, and these other people came, and they were all standing around, and they were discussing their practice or their insights and so forth. And I'm just sitting there listening to all of this. I'd much rather that everything been in silence after my own time. But nonetheless, this is what I had. So that was my practice to abandon my preference. And then at one point, they started talking about mindfulness. Now, this teacher doesn't teach mindfulness at all. This particular teacher is somewhat disdainful about mindfulness. And so this one student was saying, yeah, I did that mindfulness for a while. He said, it was interesting to see that my mind did all those things, but so what? And, of course, I was like, well, here's what. But that was a superficial level. So, yes, he got to see conceptually that his mind moved around, and he'd gotten to observe that, but he had no sense of how that related to dukkha at the end of dukkha. And there was no dropped into the whole experience. So there's many shortcomings maybe we have as Western teachers, but one of the things that I feel as though we do well is we do enough repetition and enough specificity that people get to put together a kind of profound understanding of the practice that the teaching body as a whole really helps people do that. And so I use this as an opportunity. That didn't come from your question per se. I just use that as an opportunity. But to remind you that what I said this morning about empowerment, that our offering is for this to be your practice, for your understanding. So like when I'm doing trainings with teachers-to-be, one of the things that I will say to them over and over again, and insofar as I can insist, is in terms of the four foundations of mindfulness, if you're going to be a teacher, you need, there's a vital need for you to have your own understanding of the four foundations of mindfulness. Not my understanding of it, not in one of the books' understanding, not even the Buddha's understanding, but your own understanding. What do you mean by each of these four foundations? Likewise with the Four Noble Truths, what do you mean? What is it to you if you're going to offer it? And I would say to those of you who are using mindfulness and any of your other practices affecting others, for you to take some level of ownership like that, for sure. But even in your own practice, with these core teachings that you own them and you make them yours. Now, you can have some question that you live with for many years. I certainly have questions to this day that I'm living with, and expect to have questions until the end, unless something unexpected happens. The ease with it is because I know where my questions are, you see. And I don't necessarily think that the way I perceive something today will be the way I will perceive it 5 years from now, like I was again saying yesterday. But I have some relationship to it that is my relationship to it now, so therefore the relationship can grow. If you're in a passive accepting, there's not an active relationship, so it's much harder for your relationship to grow. Now, because life will happen to you, it'll force it to grow. But this kind of organic vitality is that's part of the practice. That's one of the factors of enlightenment, as the seven factors of enlightenment, is this kind of vitality, this energy of that. That's individualized in terms of your immediate experience.